Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So here's one way to think about the mess that Cyprus is in. They need to come up with about 30% of their GDP, 30% of their entire economy by Monday. So how's your weekend looking anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 22nd of March. Good to have you with us. So that's a crazy number, right? Cyprus has to find a way to lay its hands on maybe $8 billion to prop up its banks in the next 48 hours. Ready? Go. Cyprus and the EU and the fate thereof is where we are going to begin today. We're going to do it with Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government. She's down in Washington. John Carney is in our studios in New York. He is from CNBC. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
All right, so John, I'm going to start with you because you were late, man. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. If I had told you, I don't know, 3 months ago that the markets would be where they are and that Cyprus would be the thing we're talking about, what would you have said I was? Nuts, crazy, insane, what?
Yeah, I would have said you're totally delusional. This was not on my radar. It wasn't on very many people's radar. It's completely experienced by most people as a black swan event. You know, this thing that jumps out at you and that you had no idea even existed is now what everybody's talking about all the time.
So, Neela, I want to run a question by you that I ran by Stephen Beard from our London Bureau earlier this week.
Sure.
Why can't we now at this point just say to Cyprus, you know what, we're done. We're finished. You're out. And let's all move on. And the rest of us can be safe instead of worrying about this island of 800,000 people.
That would be the easy solution.
Of course, we can't do that.
It's a small economy. It's actually not that much of money when it comes to bailouts. But what Cyprus is a huge political fiasco. And it's really nice to talk about some other country's dysfunction for once. but it can't be done because it really strikes to, one, the rule of law, that you can't just take money from insured deposits, and two, the viability of the European Central Bank and the EU as a whole. And that's the story we've been discussing for a couple years now.
All right, John, here's the thing that's bugging me about this, and I don't know why, but it is. The EU basically is doing what it is doing to Cyprus, squeezing them really hard because it can, right? Because Cyprus doesn't matter all that much in the grand scheme of things. It can't do it with Greece, can't do it with Italy. The EU is bullying Cyprus into this, right?
No, that's absolutely right. Okay. The Cyprus banks are dependent on the ECBs allowing them to continue to access central bank liquidity. So they are their entire economy right now is at the mercy of the EU and the European Central Bank.
So, Neela, one more thing on this before we move on. What are the odds that we have a deal on this thing Sunday evening-ish sometime right before the markets open in Tokyo?
Kai, the best bailout deals happen over the weekend. We've seen that in our own country, and I think we'll see it in this case, too.
All right, good. Let's actually stay in Washington. The Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, had one of his he does them four times a year, press conferences, Neela. No big surprises on the policy front, but he did seem positive, right?
Yes, and that's a refreshing note for a chairman.
You're
to
all sunshine and light this week, man.
I am. You know, Indiana University, my alma mater, is a pick to win by President Obama, so I have reason to be. But I think Bernanke is really looking at the seeds of growth in the economy, and he is got this plan that has clear targets, which is a 6.5% employment rate, and he sees an economy moving in that direction.
But a 6.5% unemployment rate, John, might as well be on the dark side of the moon, right? How are we doing so far?
Well, so Bernanke has a very tricky task. He both doesn't want to talk down the economy, but at the same time, he doesn't want, by sounding too cheerful and bright about how the economy is doing, for everybody to panic and say, whoa, the Fed's going to stop QE. It's going to raise interest rates.
Yeah, quantitative easing, right?
So that's the great thing about these targets, is they let us know that no matter how happy Ben Bernanke sounds at his press conference or how gleeful he sounds about the economy, that he's still not going to pull away the extra juice that the Fed is providing until we reach those targets. So that provides him some ability to sound a little cheerier.
You don't actually think he sounded happy, right?
For Ben Bernanke, he's allowed to talk about the good things in the economy now, where before it was much more difficult because of the way the market would react.
That's actually a good lesson. John Carney from CNBC and Nilla Richardson from Bloomberg Government down in Washington. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
All right. We'll see you. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, traders are just having a good day, I think. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been a good week for the American housing market. We learned almost 2 million homeowners went from being underwater on their mortgages to above water. And construction of new homes hit a four-year high, which is very good news for A, construction workers, think employment, and B, providers of the materials those workers use to build those new homes. Today, Georgia-Pacific said it's going to spend $400 million to meet growing demand for plywood and other kinds of construction lumber, but maybe it's not going to spend it soon enough because those prices are likely to stay high for that stuff. Adam Allington reports.
The forklifts at Byers Lumberyard in St. Louis are zipping back and forth, an early sign of what's shaping up to be a busy building season. One catch, costs for raw materials like 2x4s and plywood are sky high right now.
Plywood prices have shot up every day. I mean, they're rising all the time.
Bob Brown is the manager at Byers, and you'd think after the cold, dark winter of the construction industry's discontent, the news that housing is back would put a smile on his face. But then he calls up his lumber supplier.
Every time we call, prices are higher.
The main reason is that supplies of plywood are unusually low. Greg Lewis tracks wood panel supplies for Forest Economic Advisors.
The issue is that inventory levels are extremely low because everything that's being produced is being consumed right away.
A year ago, the composite price for wood panels was just over $350 per 1,000 square feet. Today, it's more like $500. That's according to Random Lengths, a trade publication for the wood products industry. John Anderson is the publisher.
The industry reduced its output dramatically when the housing market crashed, and this happened like never before.
Mark Luders heads the building products division at Georgia Pacific. He says his company scaled back production 30% to 40% after the housing collapse, and it's going to take some time to get back up to speed.
The projects we're talking about doing right now will probably take about 18 months to 2 years to put in place.
As long as domestic supplies remain tight, retailers and wholesalers have little choice but to import or keep prices high. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The brand spanking new BlackBerry 10 hit stores today. It's the company's latest effort at keeping itself a distant third in the smartphone wars. Not just me being mean, you know, BlackBerry shares off 8% today. All right, moving on. There is, sitting on the shelves in the refrigerated section of your local convenience store, a soon-to-be antique. It's the Pepsi bottle. The number two soda maker has been losing market share to Coke the past couple of years. So as part of its, hey, we got to turn things around plan, it's going to be rolling out a new shape for its single-serving bottles come next month. The first redesign, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark tells us, in about 17 years.
What difference does the shape of a bottle make? It affects how many you can ship at once. Square-shaped bottles, I know, weird, but there are some, are the most space-efficient. You also want to think about whether the bottle will fit in a cup holder. John Whaley manages industrial design at the firm D2M. He says in the case of Pepsi's new bottle, the biggest change is to the bottom half of the bottle. It's going to have these really sculpted-looking finger grips.
If you can grip it, that means you can open it easier, releasing that lid and having the carbonation.
Whaley's not saying the average customer is thinking about that tss and how the finger grips might enhance it when they walk into a store and grab a bottle.
But when they do pick it up, it's those little subtleties that I think add to the entire experience.
Or maybe it's not just the subtleties, says Tom Perko. He's a consultant at Bevmark who's worked with Pepsi in the past.
They probably used the lug nut for their inspiration. This is a pretty heavy-duty, masculine kind of approach to bottle design.
Which might be a good idea, since young men are Pepsi's biggest customers. Customers Pepsi is scrambling to keep. Their soda sales declined by 4% last year in North America. But Perko has a warning.
Changing a bottle shape isn't going to change who Pepsi is. I mean, they've got to figure out whether or not they can successfully sell soft drinks to the American public.
Perko says as more Americans link sugary drinks to obesity, Pepsi sales may have less to do with the bottle and more to do with what's inside. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
For a long time, I'm talking decades here, conventional wisdom was that the best way for low and middle-income families to build wealth wasn't the stock market. It was real estate, buying a house, the American dream and all, appreciation over time. But then the last 6 years happened, a housing bust where a whole bunch of low-income Americans lost their homes. So, from the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Tracy Samuelson looks at whether homeownership is still the right path, the right dream, if you will, for lower-income families.
This is a foreclosed home, and it's not going to be pretty.
It's a townhouse outside St. Louis. $45,000 for a couple of bedrooms and a kitchen ceiling that's, well, not much of a kitchen ceiling. Brian Mack doesn't even bother to look upstairs.
Yeah, all that, the ceiling and everything, I don't want to deal with that.
Brianne isn't interested in fixing up someone else's mistake because she doesn't want to make one of her own. She's thinking really carefully about what she can afford on her $33,000 salary, and costly repairs could eat up her savings. She spent the last 4 years paying off all her debt, and she's been pre-approved for a $90,000 loan. If it's backed by the Federal Housing Administration, her down payment could be just about 3% of that.
I want to try to make sure that I'm okay, that I'm financially, I can pay for the house, the down payment is, and if I need furniture, I can do that. So I have to be realistic in it.
We want people to go into this eyes wide open.
Chris Kramer runs Beyond Housing, a nonprofit that does neighborhood development. He says caution, like Brianne's, is the silver lining of the housing crisis. His organization is giving her financial counseling and maybe a few $1,000s for a down payment. With the right mortgage, Kramer still thinks owning a home is the best way to help build wealth and pass that wealth on to future generations.
No matter what your income is, you know, home ownership is possible for folks.
Really, no matter what your income
is? Well, is there some number where you can't? Sure. But just to say arbitrarily, if you make less than $26,000, you can't become a homeowner, that may not be true.
But getting the less well-off into a home is harder, more complicated now. Beyond Housing runs home buyer education classes to help people through the process.
But underwriters, that's the gatekeeper. They're looking at more factors, than they used to.
Coretta Johnson already knew that she had to pay down her credit card debt, but she's just learned that routinely overdrawing her bank account, which she does once or twice a month, could look bad on her loan application.
That's hurting me right now because I know I'm a responsible individual and I just want to leave my kids something. I want to have something in my life that I said I accomplished and I did.
And there's a slew of other benefits to home ownership, says Ray Bashar with the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis.
Typically, homeowners have about 35 times the wealth of renters.
They get tax subsidies. They tend to save more. Kids of homeowners are even more likely to go to college.
So the problem is not home ownership. The problem is if you only pursue home ownership.
In 2007, the bottom 30% of homeowners had over half their total assets in their homes. And that's just too risky. So Bashara is still pro-home ownership for low-income families. But now, post-housing crisis, he also thinks that people need to build more in plain old vanilla savings and look for other investments.
Historically, the stock market has outperformed the housing market in terms of an investment. Many people think that it's even wrong to think about a home as an investment, given the risks.
But stocks can be a tough sell. Here's Coretta again.
It's kind of scary, though. I did do the Roth IRA listening to, what's her name? You know, Oprah.
Susie Orman.
That's her. I mean, I'd rather lock my money up in something that's benefiting me.
A house is an investment Coretta can live in. She wants a one-story home where she can grow old. And enough room for a king-size bed. In St. Louis, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I don't know if you're a black person sitting around saying, hey, I can go to Marriott now because they like Jackie Robinson.
Sometimes marketing campaigns raise more questions than they answer. But first, let's do the numbers. If the markets are worried about what's happening in Cyprus, they're not telling. The Dow Industrials rallied 0.6%, 90 points, closed at 14,512. The NASDAQ spiced up 0.7%, 22 points, finished at 3,245. The S&P 500 took home an extra 0.7% today, 11 points, 1,556 is your number there. For the week, though, just a bit of a downer. The Dow was flat. NASDAQ eased 0.1%. The S&P 500 gave back 0.2%. Big day for Nike. Shares ran up 11% today after the company posted better profits than Wall Street expected. Tiffany also got its game on, shining up 2%. Investors saw a big bargain in Groupon. Shares in the Daily Deal Company were up 6% today. On the financials front, Goldman Sachs and JPMorgan Chase both picked up 0.8%. Morgan Stanley took home about 0.5%. Bond prices fell just a smidge. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.93%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, things are a little quiet. Congress is out on break for 2 weeks. The Jewish celebration Passover begins at sundown. And writer and activist Gloria Steinem turns 79. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a nice weekend.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. I spent a good amount of time out in Montana last year working on a television documentary for Frontline that I think we talked about a couple of times on this broadcast. Montana is, I can tell you, very much its own place, and Montanans like to be left alone to do what they want to do, which today is to consider a law that lets drivers take home big game animals that they've hit with their car. As so often happens, Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on the odd animal story beat for us today.
There you are, driving home, thinking about what it is you're going to eat for dinner when, thwomp, you peg a deer. Angie Reinach is from State Farm Insurance.
It's actually very common. We're estimating about 1.25 million drivers every year has some sort of altercation with a deer while in their car.
Deer altercations can cause some real damage.
About $3,300 is the average claim cost.
The Montana legislature wants to help take the sting out of that bill by allowing you to take home your deer as a bit of a concession prize. Here's Montana State Senator Larry Gent during debate.
This is a bill that allows a law enforcement officer to issue a permit to take, that is to possess, a roadkill animal if it's a deer, an elk, a moose, or an antelope. If the motorist is the person whose vehicle smote that particular creature to death.
And here's State Senator Jonathan Windy Boy.
I support this bill because I have a couple of hunters at home that have poor luck, and I hope this would help them.
But there's a problem with this plan. A deer that's been slammed by a car might not have that much edible meat. Nick Bennett owns Montana Mobile Meats and processes wild game.
Blood will go into that muscle, and that meat is no good.
Just how much meat you can get out of that roadkill depends on exactly where and how hard you hit it. The hide isn't worth that much either, maybe in the range of $5. Hardly solace. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
In our continuing mission to provide news you can use, you got to check our website today. Our new media gang put together a state-by-state map of the likelihood of you hitting a deer with your car, and better yet, whether you get to keep it. If you do, it's marketplace.org. Even if you haven't seen it, you know the story of Argo, right? Ben Affleck's Best Picture-winning movie about the Iranian hostage crisis. The central plot point, and I'm pretty sure I'm not spoiling anything here, is about a fake Hollywood movie that sets up the rescue. There's a tax lawsuit afoot over in the UK with a similar story, but with a far less noble aim, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
When the British Movie Project was unveiled in film industry magazines, it looked very promising. A budget of $30 million and talk of A-list actors. But there was one little problem.
This was a fake movie. It was an imaginary project.
Tax expert John Whiting says the movie was merely a vehicle for fraudulently claiming tax relief from the British government.
The film didn't exist in reality. It existed on paper, lots of creative invoices. What that was all about was a tax fraud.
But the tax authorities rumbled it. So in a desperate bid to cover their tracks, the fraudsters decided to slap together a real movie. They hired a low-budget filmmaker, Paul Knight, to make a feature film, Fast.
When I asked why a quick turnaround, they said because they wanted to get it ready to take to the American film market in November. Seemed logical at the time, so we agreed.
And this was the result. A thriller written, cast, shot and edited on a shoestring budget of $150,000, all within 4 months, by a cast and crew who were completely unaware of the scam.
He's a dead man.
Paul Knight and his team were congratulating themselves.
We came in under budget and on time. So for us, as obviously filmmakers, it was a huge achievement and we was all very proud. And
you won an award.
And we won an award.
A silver ace at last year's Las Vegas Film Festival. But the tax authorities were not impressed or duped. They prosecuted the producers who were convicted of fraud. With the movie tied up in red tape, Knight is out of pocket. But in the wake of Argo's success, he spotted a way of plucking triumph out of the disaster.
We are toying with now writing a screenplay about it. If Ben Affleck would like to contact me, by all means, I'm happy to discuss. Perhaps we can win next year's Oscars with this story.
No prizes for the hapless producers. They'll be sentenced next week. But did they secretly want to get caught? They did leave a huge incriminating clue in the title of their cover-up movie, A Landscape of Lies. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's a movie coming out in a couple of weeks that's getting some buzz. Baseball fans will know what it's about as soon as I give you the title. 42, just the number, Jackie Robinson's jersey number, in fact. The marketing campaign is gearing up, including a tie-in with Marriott, the hotel chain. It's paired up with Warner Brothers to be the film's official hotel partner. Free tickets, other enticements to attract minorities to join the Marriott Loyalty Rewards Program. We got Wesley Morris, the film critic at Grantland, on the line to try to make some sense of it all. Hey, Wesley.
Hey, Kai. How's it going?
It's going all right, but I have to tell you, I cannot quite figure this movie out. Maybe it's just me, but Marriott and a movie about Jackie Robinson, make that connection for me.
There isn't a connection. I mean, I guess Jackie Robinson at some point, you know, was on the road a lot when he was playing, but I don't think he was staying in a Marriott for any number of reasons. That's not a slight against Marriott. It's just, you know, the time at the time.
Yeah. Let's back up for a minute, though, Wesley, and set the stage a bit. It's kind of amazing that there has not yet been, as they say, a biopic about Jackie Robinson made yet.
Just for the record, I hate that word. I hate, okay. You know, it's a necessary word, I guess, but and you said it right, too. It's not biopic.
Do people actually say biopic?
People say that. No, like right. It's a field of study or something.
Anyway, one has not been made.
No, and partly that's due to the fact that the rights have been held on to for so long. You know, Jackie Robinson's widow, Rachel, she just held on to it for any number of reasons, but one of them was just the sanctity of it, of their story, and she just refused to relinquish the rights.
What are we to make of the fact that Warner Brothers is not talking at all about his partnership with Marriott? I mean, that kind of speaks volumes.
I don't know. I mean, that's sort of the worrying part. I mean, it would seem to me that it would be an opportunity for them to say, hey, we love what Marriott does. We love, you know, their interest in Jackie Robinson. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would like to know what they think the relationship between these two things is. And so without anybody saying anything, you're just left to speculate. And the speculation to me, as it, you know, as it does you, leads you down these cynical roads.
So do you think this is going to work at all? I mean, is it going to actually get more people involved in the Marriott, more minorities and people of color involved in the Marriott's reward program or not?
I just wonder, like, does Marriott have a minority problem? I mean, I just don't know. I mean, they have a diversity commitment and they're interested in multiculturalism in the way that all corporations say they are. I just don't know. I don't know if you're a black person sitting around saying, hey, I can go to Marriott now because they like Jackie Robinson. I mean, Jackie Robinson is like, you know, there's nobody. It's like he's like air. Like there's nobody who doesn't like Jackie Robinson. I just don't think this is something that sort of would distinguish Marriott from any other corporation.
Right. Wesley Morris, he covers films and a whole bunch more at Grantland. Wesley, thanks a lot, man.
Thanks a lot, Kai. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, kind of a charming little story, I thought. Turns out the new Pope didn't cancel his newspaper delivery when he left Argentina to go to the conclave last month. So today, Francis called the news kiosk on the corner of his old street in Buenos Aires, said he's not going to be back for a while. Go ahead and cancel it. The guy answering the phone thought it was a prank until the Pope said, no, seriously, it's Jorge Bergoglio calling from Rome. Turns out, by the way, that then Cardinal Bergoglio saved the rubber bands his newspapers came wrapped in, brought him back to that kiosk every single month. I just like that story. That's it. Happy Friday. You know how it goes. All right, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 0.6%, about 90 points. The NASDAQ spiced up 0.7%, 22 points. The S&P 500 took home an extra 0.7% as well, 11 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, it's never too early to think about saving for retirement. Or is it?
When I think about retirement, I think about like having a 401k or something, a pension. I don't really know what these things are. But then I can like relax, you know, on my like imaginary beach house.
And imaginary it will stay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.